apparently the blitzing of backyards and doing anything remotely horticultural was all the rage. I didn't have a TV, but from what they tell me, I could have given any celebrity gardener a run for their money. I'd collected seeds from the various deals of pot I'd bought or been given and figured the rainforest would be a great place to start a crop of my own. I planted my seeds about 200 metres upstream from camp, close enough that I could keep a good eye on them, but far enough from home base that I wouldn't be guilty by association. I usually started off with 20 to 25 seedlings, but by the time harvest rolled around in late May to early June, I'd have 5 to 7 plants left. The attrition occurred through the process of eliminating the males, because only the females go on to develop the prized heads, or buds. The buds are packed with the cherished active chemical, THC. Once the males were dispatched, more foliage would be lost as I plucked plants clean to give me something to smoke while I waited for the rest to mature. Still, the harvest was usually pretty decent. I'd end up with full plants that had quite a bit on them, maybe 3/4 of a pound in total. I could never be sure because I didn't have any scales. I think that was a part of what made my barters and trade so strong. I tended to guesstimate an ounce and give overly generous deals. While I might have been unselfish in that regard, I was hyper-paranoid about who I traded with. To begin with, the only people I sold or traded pot with were introduced to me by Heather. It took a couple more years before I established a regular customer base, mainly due to being untrusting. Because I was heavily into addiction myself, I could easily pick who was a drug user and who wasn't. There wasn't much chance I was going to get busted selling it to an undercover cop, but paranoia is paranoia. Perhaps the most challenging part about cultivating and dealing pot from my base up on the mountain was working out how to preserve my supply through the winter months. I had to figure out a preventive step, otherwise the perennial mists and humidity would turn my mega stash into blackened, decayed mush within a few days. Months of work would be lost. Once again, the mighty Byron Shire Echo came to the rescue. Even though I was growing and selling and trading in drugs, I never viewed the process as a means of making money per se. It wasn't an enterprise or a business. For me, it was purely about survival, managing trauma, and providing some comforts and quality of life for a part of the year, be it alcohol, food, or a tarpaulin. I was hardly Pablo Escobar, with a mansion in the mountains and a private plane to whisk me down to Mullumbimby and Byron Bay. But like Pablo, I was well aware it was a criminal activity and I was suitably security conscious. Fortunately, I had a pretty good idea of who was coming and going in the forest, right down to which trails people might take. The biggest threat would arrive out of the blue every other year or so in the form of the police air wing patrol. Whenever their helicopters clattered into the canyon below, I'd become incredibly anxious. The fire would be extinguished and I'd scatter leaf litter and twigs over the bare patches of the lava rock. From the air, bare rock beneath the trees would be a sure sign of human activity and grounds to search the area. I'd go to great lengths to camouflage myself against airborne surveillance. Everything in the camp would be dismantled and carefully hidden in the undergrowth. My tarp, backpack and cooking equipment were all strategically stashed, and whenever the helicopter came anywhere near, I'd dive underneath the bushes. For some reason, the coppers tended to concentrate their efforts down in the canyon rather than up on top of the mountain where I was up to no good. Sometimes, they'd buzz the cliff top, and every now and then, they'd get so close that I could clearly see the people inside from my little hidey hole in the scrub. My luck held for years, and my crop was never discovered, unlike Pablo Escobar. In truth, cultivating marijuana in the forest was a comparatively carefree exercise, and I have to say, mine was well-tended crop. The TV gardeners would have been impressed. In the beginning, I used the offal from whatever animal I'd killed as fertilizer, particularly the lamb mullet. Later, after I went vegetarian, I sourced guts and fish heads from shops in Byron, Brunsbury Heads. I even once traded a couple of ounces of mull with heather in return for some bags of Dynamic Lifter. After a couple of seasons, I had the growing of dope down to a fine art, and I became quite attached to it. One year, when the forest was particularly parched through drought, the creek dried up and I had to carry water in a plastic shopping bag from a waterhole 30 metres downstream. I did whatever it took to look after my plants. During my expeditions across the mountain, I discovered there was a good reason why the police conducted aerial patrols. I was hardly Robinson Crusoe of local drug growers in that neck of the woods. My policy whenever I found someone else's plantation was to strip one plant of all its foliage, leaving a bare stem and all the other plants untouched. That way, the growers knew that their crop had been found, but it wasn't under threat from raiders or the police. It was more like a reassuring wink. Oi, I know you're here, but there's nothing to worry about. The last thing I wanted in the forest was other growers hunting down thieves. Besides, I knew how I would have felt if someone had robbed me. I even felt retrospectively guilty about the plants that I ripped off in Bowen with Danny Doyle.